Good morning. My name is Trent Robinson. I am one of the leaders here, and this morning and throughout the next month, since Pastor Brian is out, for the most part, I get the privilege of opening the scripture with you. I get the privilege of going through God's word together, and I love it. And it's so good to be here with you guys. It really is, Pastor Brian has said it before, it really is one of my favorite parts of the week, is to be here, to be able to have these conversations. I love relationships, so it's awesome. Let me put you guys on the spot now. New Year's resolutions. Anyone make them? Who here makes New Year's resolutions? Does anyone make them? Not really. Does anyone do word of the year? You guys ever done that? Like, I want to pick a word that maybe defines my next year. I'll say my wife's family does that. So I do that with them, right? And for this year, I chose discipline because I want to be more disciplined in a lot of the small things that I need to do. I can be motivated when there's something like urgent or when there's something I need, like it's really important. But all the small things, like let's just say laundry, I just want to be disciplined in doing them, right? So that's my word. Greg, can I put you on blast? What is your word? Did you decide it yet?
Accountability.
Great word, right? So what, if I can continue with you, what made you choose accountability? Yeah. Absolutely. That's good. Yeah. What needs to get done will get done because you have somebody to support you in doing it. It's a mutual brotherhood and it's important, right? So we choose New Year's resolutions. A lot of people do it. Or they choose like words of the year or things that they want to change. I mean, even if you don't do it on this macro level of New Year's, right? We always choose things that need improvement in our lives. And we usually decide on these things because we saw something that needed improvement in our life. So first you identified, and then you chose to do something about it. So then my next question, and this is probably why many of you don't do New Year's resolutions, is why do so many of them get abandoned? Why do they never get completed? In fact, there's an article written by the Fisher College of Business that stated that only 9% of Americans that make resolutions actually complete them. Research goes on to show that 23% of people quit by the first week of January, and 43% don't make it through the month of January. Why is this? The same article actually suggested a couple reasons, and I think they're pretty valid. Number one, poor motivation for change. Changing for the sake of change is not a great reason to change, right? So New Year's comes up, and people are like, all right, well, it's a tradition. We got to pick something that needs to change. There's not much motivation behind that, is there? I'm just picking something to pick it. So why would I follow through with it? In order for us to have good motivation, we need to actually see clearly the reason and then fully buy into it. I mean, think of it this way. Drug addicts don't stop their addiction, but let me speak for my friend first. I have a friend that had issues with drugs in high school, and he OD'd one day. He doesn't have drug addiction anymore. It's because he had to face something so real, so raw, that it motivated his change. And so we'll come back to that later as we talk through some concepts. Number two, obstacles. Challenges will arise, whether internally or externally, and usually when it gets hard, we resign. We often give up. And number three, lack of accountability. Lack of accountability. No one walked alongside us or held us to the goal that we set. If I say in front of people, I want to be more disciplined, it's a great thing. But if I don't set anyone up to help me be disciplined, then when I don't want to do something, I'm not going to do something. And so this morning and over the next several weeks, we are going to be talking about the obstacles that get in the way of living how we want and ought to live. In addition, we're going to explore the reasons and ways to overcome some of these obstacles. And it all starts with cleaning the lens. This series is going to be all about seeing ourselves and God rightly. If we can do that, it's life-changing. It's about seeing ourselves and God rightly. It's not about condemnation. I mean, you can see pride up on the screen. It's not about condemnation. It's not about crazy altar calls so we can boast in how many people came down and rededicated their lives. This is about reflection and spirit-led transformation. So what is the lens? What is a lens, right? Anyone want to answer that? What's a lens? How we view ourselves, but sure, what's a lens on a camera? Let's make it even more general. Yeah. How you see the world around you? Sure. Lens on a camera. What does it do? Mm-hmm. Focus. Sure. All true statements, right? So a lens, like on a camera, bends light and focuses it for greater clarity. And our eyes have the same thing. Our eyes have a lens. And it focuses the shot. It keeps things from appearing blurry. Our eyes are so fascinating what they do. They do so many different functions. Matthew 6:22-23 says, "The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. It will be clear. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. It will be blurry. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" And so this is a battle between light and darkness. And this series is going to progress through the seven deadly sins as the seven primary obstacles that stand in our way of living fully, of seeing clearly, of walking confidently, of standing in God's presence, of being light. So here's the seven. If you don't know the seven, here's the seven. Pride, greed, envy, gluttony, wrath, lust, and sloth. These are the seven. And this is not a comprehensive list of all sin. Nowhere in the Bible are these things compiled into one singular list, or are they called deadly sins? But a Christian monk named Evagrius Ponticus in the 4th century decided that this list of seven sins represented or summarized the seven behaviors or feelings that inspire further sin. So this is it's a catch-all, basically. In these seven, these are the primary motivators for other sins that come out. And so our study is this. To summarize it very succinctly, our study is this. The sins that derail us and the virtues that make us. The sins that corrupt our life. The sins that cause us to live short of a good standard. The sins that make us full of darkness. That blur our vision, and then the virtues that, by God's grace, get us back on track. So let's start with pride. Let's start with pride this week. And this is intentional. Pride has to be the starting point. It has to. I looked at these seven. It wasn't a coin toss. It wasn't a random number generator. Pride has to be the start because pride tends to be the foundational sin. It tends to be the foundational sin. In a stream, it would be upstream, and all these other that we're going to talk about are downstream, and they come out of that same source. In fact, I did this just more for fun, but here's the underlying thoughts behind the other sins. Greed, I deserve more. I deserve more. Envy, I deserve more than you. Gluttony, it's all for my consumption. Whatever I want, it's for my consumption. Wrath, I have to be right. And this one may seem weird, but it tends to be where if you're not right, that's when you get angry. Lust, others serve to please me. And sloth, it is not my responsibility, so I don't have to do anything. And so the enemy, kill, steal, destroy, the enemy is perfectly fine with us finding freedom from some of these other sins. As long as we still maintain pride. So let's say I show up and I say, guys, I've become super generous now. I'm doing so good. You know, like I'm giving out my finances, my time. I'm awesome. You know, like I'm over the sin of greed. And the enemy's like, great. You're not over yourself at all because you accomplished that on your own. In essence, pride is such a core issue that the enemy would be happy having your flu cured if he's giving you cancer the whole time. So let's talk about what pride looks like. What does this cancer look like? Because it can take many different forms in your life, in my life. Number one, it looks like arrogance. This is the easiest one for us. And it's really easy to see in others, isn't it? It's like you look at somebody and you're like, wow, that person's just dominating this conversation. That person is just the center of attention in this room. It's easy to see in others. You're like, yeah, that person's arrogant. They're only boasting about themselves. And the honest confession is that we tend to be jealous. No matter how much of a person you are that's like, I don't like attention, you know, I'd rather be in the background, there's still that part of you that wants to be noticed and admired. And so we look at those people and we're like, it's easier to see arrogance whenever there's arrogance that exists in us, whether how dormant it is. Sorry. Number two, self-loathing. Bet you didn't see that one coming. This one is hard, and this is not just from my thought. This is research. This is lessons I've learned. Pride can look like self-loathing because God created us exactly how he wanted. And when I demean myself, when I say that I am worthless, I'm telling God that he's wrong and he made a mistake with me, which he didn't. And I know this is a real battle for some in this room. It is. And there's no shame in this moment, but recognize that God's voice is much more loving than your own. They are not the same voice. Let him speak over you. Let him determine how beloved you truly are, because pride is to say, I don't need his voice. I'm good with my own. Number three, pride is the sin of comparison. It's the sin of comparison. I'm going to give you two examples. Number one, let's say I look at the news. Maybe one part of me wants to be informed. And that's probably true. Maybe I do want to be informed. Maybe I want to know what's going on in the world. That's totally good. But I think there's another part of us that if it's unchecked, we'll look at news stories and say, thank goodness I'm not like him. Like a news story comes on and it's like two people are murdered. And you're like, I ain't a murderer. I may have these issues, but at least it's not like that. Social media. There are posts for comparison. People post just so that they can make their life look good. People post, and then you read that and you feel lesser, right? You're like, well, I didn't get to go to Bermuda. There's posts on attack. Those passive-aggressive attacks. And so often, social media becomes a platform that's used to determine who and how I am. And on top of it, it's so easy to lose empathy because we're so focused on ourselves. How many people liked my post? Why is that person getting to do something that I'm not getting to do? And there are right ways to interact with both of these things. I just picked two. There are right ways to interact with both of them. However, we must learn to evaluate ourselves clearly. And number four, this one's relatively self-explanatory, self-reliance. When we begin to believe that we are good enough on our own, that we don't need others or God. And all four of these presentations of pride have self at the center of one's own universe, and that is the core of it. What if Jesus had self at the center of his own universe? What if Jesus came down and he was selfish, right? Like, things would be drastically different. Ew, those people are sick. You want me to go touch them? Do you see the wart on that guy? Like, I ain't getting sick. Or, you know, like, Judas is going to betray me? Oh, I'm going to hurt him before he gets to hurt me. Or the main one, right? It's like, you want me to go up there? You telling me you want me to go up? Do you see those nails? I'll pass. But that's not Jesus. It's not Jesus at all. But that might be some of us at times. That's me at times. It's not Jesus, because Jesus was humble and selfless, and he modeled it perfectly. That's our original design, by the way. That's how we were designed, but we drifted from that quite quickly. In fact, let's look at Genesis real quick. Eve is responding to the serpent. And she said, God did say you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it or you will die. You will not certainly die, the serpent said to the woman. For God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took and ate it, and Adam ate it too. Pleasing to the eye. Her vision in that moment got cloudy, blurry, it got dark because of the pride within her. Sin started with pride. Satan wanted to be like God. Adam and Eve thought God was holding out and wanted to be like God. We need to be like God, but we don't want to be like God in the ways that we get to determine for ourselves and we are all powerful and we are. No, we need to be like Jesus, who was humble and gave himself. And that is a hard calling. Jesus addresses this in the Gospels. He's in Luke 18, 9 through 14. And this is, if we're going to choose a main passage, this is our main passage that we're digging into. Luke 18, 9 through 14. It says this. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Feels applicable, right? And Jesus picked his audience specifically. He is in front of Pharisees, and he starts saying this. And if I'm being honest with you, I imagine the Pharisees as these prideful people, but I don't even imagine they're picking up on it yet. Like, they're gathered around, and Jesus starts speaking. And let me take you through their process, right? Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, the robbers, the evildoers, the adulterers, or even like this tax collector over here. I fast twice a week and I give a tenth of all I get. Like, are these bad things? Like, no. These aren't bad things. Fasting, praying, tithing, great things. But not a good heart. Comparison, arrogance. He has to establish that he's better than this other man. And in my mind, I picture this audience that Jesus is in front of. These Pharisees going, wow, that guy's a model. He's doing great. Like, I'm like him. I'm like him. Like, he's doing everything he needs to be doing. I'm like this dude. And Jesus is like, just wait one second. Jesus is like, just wait one second. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. There's two approaches. One brought all these good things before God. The other brought himself humbly. And I picture the Pharisees here like, yeah, that guy deserves not to look up to heaven. He's not doing what we're doing. We're doing good. Yet, Jesus says, I tell you that this man, the tax collector, rather than the other, the Pharisee, went home justified. And this is when all the, like, the mic drops. All the Pharisees are like, what? What are you saying? Because this is the upside down kingdom for them. They're like, no, we've been doing everything right. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. The man that brought only himself humbly, rather than the one that's done all these good things proudly, the humble man received Jesus. He received the blessing, the favor. Meanwhile, this other guy, what he received is the good feeling he got when he boasted in himself. That was his reward. There you go. You made yourself feel good. Go on out. And we know this teaching well. Even if this is your first time in church ever, you've never touched foot in church, you know this teaching to be true. Let me give you the example. Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before destruction. A haughty spirit goes before a fall. Pride goes before the fall. We all know this. We would say this. It's common. Or even this one is less well known, but if anyone thinks they are something when they are not, they deceive themselves. If a duck thinks he's a beaver when he's actually a duck, he's lying to himself. It's true. And so the truth boils down to this. If you are on the throne of your life, Jesus is on the cross. If Jesus is on the throne of your life, you are on the cross. So if I elevate myself and I live for myself, then I say what Jesus did for me doesn't matter to me. And I leave him on the cross because that was the reason he was on the cross in the first place, was for my sins. He wanted to take those so that I didn't have to live for myself. Because it's a bad place to be. Our pride is what put Jesus on the cross. But the other one's hard, I'll be honest. If Jesus is on the throne of my life, which he should be, if I am elevating him the way I should, then I am on the cross. Because our calling is to die to ourselves. It's to die to ourselves that he may lead and reign. And that's not easy. Matthew 16, 24 through 25 is Jesus saying, he told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his own life, whoever hoard onto his own life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And Jesus is the model for this. He doesn't just say it and then let it be, right? I mean, he goes on the cross. Philippians 2, 7 through 8 says, he made himself nothing. Nothing. By taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. So to humble yourself is to die to yourself, meaning that the life you live is not all about you. All of pride destroys you. All of Jesus destroys pride. And this is why I preface it, right? All of pride destroys you. This is a sin that will derail your life. All of pride destroys you, but all of Jesus destroys pride, especially when we remember that there is a God and that you are not him. That he saved my life. He saved my life. I did not do it on my own. I didn't deserve it either. Especially when I own my own brokenness. I own that I'm falling short. And that it's my fault. That I'm a sinner. That's hard. So what is the answer then? What's the answer to all of this? It's humility. Jesus modeled humility. This is the virtue that sets us free from being self-centered. So if pride derails us, then humility puts us back on track through God's power. But let me address your thoughts. I put myself in your shoes. Let me address your thoughts if you are anything like me from what I just said. I know it, but how do I live it? I want it, but why do I not seem to get it? Humility is great. It's a great thing. I think it's an awesome idea, but I'm still full of pride. Yeah, me too. In fact, last year, a little over a year ago, I was back at college. Yes, I'm new out of college. I was back at college, and I started noticing these underlying thoughts. These things that when I was in a car by myself, I would think to myself. And they were quite toxic and arrogant and prideful, and I didn't like who I was because of them. And so I ended up talking to some of my roommates at the time, and thank the Lord I was in an environment that made counseling an appealing thing, not a thing just for those that are really bad off, but it was actually for those that just needed to be healthy. And so I started attending counseling. And I started talking through these thoughts that I knew if I let persist would wreck my marriage. They would wreck my friendships. They would wreck my life. Because the underlying thoughts that we allow to be there, even if we don't presently entertain them, but they're still there, those things are going to affect your relationships, whether it's with yourself, with others, or with God. And so all that to say, me too. I spent weeks in counseling, and I'm still not a fixed man, but I'm glad that I at least talked out these things that were I was allowing to persist in my mind. So, many of you didn't choose a resolution, and that's totally okay. Let me present it like this, though. What if humility became a resolution of ours? What if it became a change of ours together as a church? What if that was something we decided on? And my question would be, How do we not quit the resolution of humility? If only 9% of resolutions are coming true, then why would I even present it like that? That sounds like a horrible idea. Only 9% of us learn to be a little more humble? It's bad for a pastor, right? How do we not quit the resolution of humility? Well, let me flip the same things that cause us to lose it. What if we had a solid motivation for change? Like, we actually see clearly the reason humility is so needed and we fully buy into it. It's not, Jesus told me to, which he did, and it's true, and it should be good motivation, but, like, I'll be honest with you, it probably won't convince my heart. Like, I agree with it logically, but I don't know if I'm going to change just by it. And I wish I would, but I'm being honest with you. It's more like, I know pride. I know pride. I see how it is killing me. And so what if we could actually identify the areas that pride in our life was being toxic? The thoughts that we entertain that we don't like how that makes us be. The person that we would be if we spoke all of those thoughts, right? And what if we realized the actual need of it and that was our OD moment? That we actually saw sin for what it is, that it's killing us, and that sparked enough of a change for a solid motivation. Because I don't want to be consumed by myself and hurt others I love. God called me to more. Number two, enduring obstacles. So instead of letting obstacles deter us, what if we endured them? Not ignored them. You can ignore things for a little bit, but eventually it'll come up. We learned perseverance. We endured obstacles. I had a leader. I will reference him a million times if I'm up on the stage because he was very influential. But throughout college, I had a leader named Doug Damon. And he had four boys of his own, and then he's leading a group of like 24 men at college ministry. And he has these Damonisms, these wise sayings that he's collected throughout his life. That's like how he instills virtues into his men. So, you know, there's things like it's impossible to be bent out of shape if you're flexible. There are things that are very memorable too. Like I remember all of the ones that he's taught. But one of them is dead men know no offense. Dead men know no offense. And it means that because this life is not all about me, because logically it's not all about me, I should not take offense to everything that rubs me the wrong way. And this is hard. But here's an example of an obstacle. When I get rubbed the wrong way, it's easy for me to flare up and be prideful, to defend myself. And that's why I say it's enduring obstacles, not ignoring them. And so think of someone that rubs you the wrong way. Probably not a hard task, all in all. Enduring obstacles in the journey of humility. And this is why I say enduring obstacles. Is loving that person well. It's serving them. It's willing to make yourself look silly or even kill your reputation. One of the hardest things ever is to get over your reputation, to kill your reputation in order to meet their needs. That's enduring obstacles, and it's a hard challenge. And I don't think it happens apart from the other two, if I'm being honest. And sometimes we pray to God for strength in that aim because that's the only thing we can do. And number three, the thing that'll help that aim, maintaining accountability. Very few goals succeed in isolation. It's a life lesson, not a church lesson, life lesson. Very few goals, very few aims will succeed in isolation. So let's say I choose to start working out more. I'm like, I'm going to improve my physical health. So I decide Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I am going to go to the gym. And you're like, good job, Trent. And I'm like, yes. Monday rolls around. I wake up. I'm tired. Mondays are always hard. No one likes the Mondays, right? And so I feel really lazy. And I'm like, the gym just isn't going to happen today. I don't know why I thought I'd ever put it on a Monday. Mondays are just such hard days to get going. The motivation's really low. You know what? How about Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday? That's a good plan. It's a good plan. And so then Tuesday rolls around. I'm like, okay, I got this. And I actually start getting ready. I'm like, I have to make one of my days, right? So gotta start on Tuesday. What's that? Oh, somebody's in the hospital? Okay, I'll go visit them. And then I lose the prime time of my day. And then after that, I'm like, well, I'm exhausted now. I can't go. So something got in the way, and now I'm not going to go. And so then I say, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Good plan. Wait, that's a horrible plan. I don't want to do 3 days in a row. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. No, wait. Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. I don't want to do weekends. How about I just do 2 days a week? Wednesday, Friday. Does this sound familiar? Because this sounds familiar to me. Yeah. It's so easy to push things off and to let them go. But what if I presented this differently? What if Monday, Wednesday, Friday is my plan, and I have a friend that is going to text me each of those days expecting that I went? That helps some motivation, right? It's like, okay, like if I don't have a reasonable reason, like on Monday, I didn't have a reasonable reason. Nothing that was super strong. If I just said I didn't go because I'm lazy, my friend is going to be like, come on, man, pick it up. I'm going to have to feel that. I'm going to have to feel his disappointment in me for not living up to my own goal. It helps. Or what if I even took it one step further? What if this friend actually also wants to walk in this journey with me? And so every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, me and him are going to be there in the morning at 8 a.m. And I expect to see him there, and he expects to see me there. What motivation is that? If I don't show up, I left him alone. I left him out to dry. And so now I have so much more motivation because we're doing it together. And let me spoil something. Humility is something we probably all need at least a small improvement in. Some of us may need larger ones like me, but we all need some small improvement. Because life is meant to be lived with others, and goals are meant to be supported by others. And so if we all need this improvement, then we are all doing this with others. So in the walk of humility, remember a few truths. Jesus sets us free, therefore we are free indeed. What this means is humility is not an unrealistic goal. Jesus has set us free to actually learn humility. Pride will show up. It will. We are not perfect individuals. And so humility is a hard pursuit. It is not something that we easily stumble into. It is a hard pursuit. But we are a work in progress. The Spirit is still refining us to look more like Jesus in his humility, in his selflessness, in his kindness. So when we've had a long day and we snap at someone out of our pride, or when we find ourselves elevating, or we beating ourselves up by comparison, or we fill in the blank, the goal is that we would walk with Jesus away from that sin, and we would look more like Jesus and less like the things that we despise in others and especially ourselves. So this week, the challenge is twofold. The challenge is twofold, if you're willing to accept it with me. Challenge is twofold. First, it's to reflect. I told you, this whole series, Cleaning the Lens, is about reflecting. It's about seeing clearly ourselves and God. And so to reflect is this, to see what thoughts you hold that are ridiculously prideful and catch yourself in the act. Because I'll be honest, there are things that we probably allow to persist in our minds, in our hearts, that we don't even catch. And we need to see them clearly. We need to identify them to start. And then number two. So number one, reflect. Catch yourself in the act. Number two, answer. Answer this question. These two questions. What does God say about me? And who am I to him? What does God say about me? And who am I to him? Those two things will give you a right view of self. And they are pretty humbling. That the God of the universe, the one that has provided for all things, the one that has created all things, that guy, what he thinks about you, it changes everything. Because exactly who he has made you to be is exactly where you are meant to be. So does God say that you're the greatest man or woman to walk the earth? Does he say that you are worthless? How about you pray and you search the scriptures? Because he's not hidden about his feelings. If you want a starting point, read John. Start in John. You'll see a love story unfold. And here's, yeah, I'll spoil the one thing, right? He loves you incredibly. So find out what words he speaks over you. So that way it's not just your voice speaking in, or it's not just others' voices speaking in. It is his kind voice. And if we can do this, I think we support each other on this walk. So let's support each other in reading scripture, in praying, in calling out some things in truth and love. That's my challenge. Let's pray together, if you will.